Confession of Faith, Chapter 31 of Synods and Councils, up to Section 2. Section 2 of Chapter 31. As magistrates may lawfully call a synod of ministers and other fit persons to consult and advise with about matters of religion, so if magistrates be open enemies to the church, the ministers of Christ of themselves by virtue of their office, or they with other fit persons upon delegation from their churches may meet together in such assemblies. So we have a couple of points here. The first is probably the most controverted of the two, I would say, especially today. The idea that a magistrate may lawfully call a synod of ministers for consultation, to advise and consult in matters of religion, that I think a lot of people would view that as out of step with ideals of Western democracy and, you know, Jefferson's wall of separation between church and state and all of that sort of thing. And perhaps it is, but the question really isn't what does modern Western constitutional theory profess on this point. The question is, what does the Bible say? So we're going to look at that point and discuss why the Westminster Assembly makes that point. And then we'll spend a little bit of time on the idea that magistrates, when they're hostile or enemies, that the ministers have the authority among themselves to have synods and councils. Now, it is notable that with regard to this point, when the Church of Scotland adopted the Westminster Confession in their Adopting Act, they do make a couple of statements regarding the power of the magistrate, and they say that the assembly understands. Actually, this is the General Assembly in Edinburgh in 1647. The General Assembly understands some parts of the second article of the 31st chapter only of churches not settled or constituted in point of government. And that although in such churches a synod of ministers and other fit persons may be called by the magistrate's authority and nomination without any other call to consult and advise with about matters of religion, and although likewise the ministers of Christ without delegation from their churches may themselves and by virtue of their office meet together synodically in such churches not yet constituted, yet neither of these ought to be done in churches constituted and settled. And then it goes on to say it's always free to the magistrate to advise with synods of ministers and ruling elders meeting upon delegation from the churches either ordinarily or being indicated by his authority occasionally in pro renata. And it says need arises and so on. So their point with regard to this is this, that what they're trying to avoid is the construction being placed on this, and they want to make sure that you understand what we're not saying is that the only lawful synods are those that are called by the magistrate. Particularly if the magistrate is not an enemy of the church, right? So we're not advocating for some form of Erastianism. There have been charges against the Westminster Assembly that this was an Erastian point, and in fact, not only is that denied by the Church of Scotland when they adopt the Assembly, they want to make very clear that they don't they won't even countenance any kind of Erastian construction being placed upon this. I would go on to say that I don't think that the intention of the assembly, given its anti-Erastian character in general, that the intention of the assembly would have been in an Erastian direction. However, I would point this out, and this is an important thing to keep in mind. The Westminster Assembly was itself called by the magistrate, Parliament. And that was for advice and consent, consultation, in matters of religion, for settling matters of religion in the kingdoms, the three kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland. There was perceived to be an unsettled state. And for a number of reasons, the perception was also that there was not necessarily the will to reform, particularly in the Church of England, due to previous Erastianism, if there were not, I think, some kind of guarantee carrot being held out by the magistrate that this reform would be supported. It had been a hotly contested thing for quite some time, particularly in the Church of England, but also in the Church of Scotland. If you recall some of the some of the controversies in Scotland that, for example, David Calderwood relates in his True History of the Church of Scotland. There's a period of time from the 1590s until the death of James, and even after that, until the National Covenant is renewed in 1638, where this issue about synods and so on is also is hotly contested. So the Scots are very sensitive about this issue of presuming that the only lawful synod can be that in which is called by a magistrate, which the king or his delegates are being seated, and so on. They're not denying that the magistrate ought to be present, or that the magistrate ought to attend these sorts of conferences with attention to the spiritual estate of the church. You know, he has an interest in that. And I think part of what people fail to recognize here, there is a presumption on the part of the Westminster divines that national establishments are scriptural and warranted. The question is not, will we have a national establishment? The question is, what will be the character of that? And by the way, for people who think that they live in countries like the United States where we don't have a national establishment of religion, they're living in a lie. We do. Right? There is a national religion. You know, go to the Capitol building and see the paintings of George Washington being received up into heaven, and all of the rites and ceremonies surrounding affairs of government. The fact that they have their liturgical calendar, the 4th of July and Memorial Day and Labor Day and all of this, they have a calendar where they enforce you to take the day off if you work for them. Yeah.
And they also have oaths and vows as well?
They have oaths and vows. They do all kinds of things. There is an establishment. They run. The reason why the quote-unquote secular state in the West runs and inevitably falls into taking care of health, education, and welfare is because without a national established church, there's no one who's going to look over this. In Europe, when there was a national established church, those things fell to the church. They mediated between the government and the people in those affairs. Without that, you have this state. It's a religion of statism. It's Baal worship is what we have. We were to look at the nature of Baal worship. We have a state religion. The fact is, it's a false religion. And that always happens when you reject the true religion. So the assembly understood this. The assembly understood that they were choosing what kind of establishment, and particularly what kind of Christian establishment. They didn't want one that was in error. Now, saying that, it's important to recognize what the Westminster Assembly does has no binding authority in the church until it's adopted. Those adopting acts are very important.
Which is why we don't count the last one, right?
What?
The adopting act?
What?
Wasn't there 1650, like the church, or was it the church didn't ratify
something?
No,
that's you're talking about minutes of...
Okay.
We're talking about the adopting acts for the standards of the church, and the church adopts each one. And there is in our standards, you will find an adopting act for each part, for the catechisms, for the form of government, for the directory for worship. Each is adopted by the Church of Scotland, and on a couple of them, they place certain observations or certain comment, like they did on this chapter. The fact that they had covenanted, the nations had covenanted, that meant that at the end of this period of this assembly, they were under an obligation to give consideration and, if they found these things to be biblical, to adopt them as a point of uniformity between the three nations, or the three kingdoms. They were supposed to adopt the Westminster standards. The Church of Scotland is the only one of the kingdoms that actually followed through on that point. There are reasons for that, but I would argue not legitimate reasons. A lot of it has to do with the Restoration and things that were churning already in England prior to that with the Cromwellian dictatorship. So there wasn't a whole lot of time between the standards being finished by the assembly and the possibility of adopting, and you had the Civil War going on in England, which finally in 1649 led to the death of Charles I. The Cromwellian dictatorship. And so Cromwell was a sectarian. He was an independent and not a friend of Presbyterianism, not a friend of national establishments. He was, in fact, his method of government, the so-called protectorate, while it was Protestant in a general sort of way, was also a military dictatorship, and it had much more in common with the kind of fascism that we see today than you would have had or you did have under the monarchy with a covenanted national established church. So, you know, Cromwell was in some sense a foretaste of this idea of authoritative toleration where everything except for Quakerism and Romanism would be tolerated in England, and the confusion that it led to, and finally wore people out and led them to the point where they wanted the restoration of the monarchy. That's how bad it became. So I know there are people who want to argue for Cromwell's good points, and I'm sure he had some, but his bad points far outweigh the good. Anyway, we need to look then at this question of magistrates' power to call synods. That's what happened in 1643. Parliament calls for this assembly of divines. They ask for fit candidates from different areas in England and from Scotland. They ask for a delegation as well. Their job is to consider matters. that are really designed to bring, as I say, the three kingdoms in closer uniformity in matters of religion. That's all part of that solemn league and covenant, which had already been sworn by England, Scotland, and Ireland. The notion that the Westminster Assembly is Erastian is and could only be true if we understood that what they were doing was going to be binding on the church. What they were doing was giving advice, consent, consultation to matters pertaining to uniformity of religion in the national establishment. And they were speaking first in that context directly to the magistrate. There were government officials, parliamentary officials who were present for these debates and even at times took part in them. But as I said, they carried no force of power, synodic power, within any of the national churches of England, Scotland, or Ireland, apart from being adopted by them. The obligation to adopt them was really on the part of the church and the state in those three kingdoms due to the Solemn League. And that required them all to take a look at what was presented here at Westminster and adopt it if they found it to be biblical. That obviously didn't happen except in Scotland. And so it's not Erastian. And as we're going to see, in fact, the calling of synods by magistrates has a relatively long and, I think, somewhat distinguished history in the church, as well as being borne out scripturally. So I want to take note of that along the way as well. All right, so let's begin with the first question. May magistrates lawfully call a synod of ministers and other fit persons to consult and advise with about matters of religion? The answer is yes. Look at Isaiah 49:23. 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, Matthew 2, 4 and 5, and Proverbs 11, 14.
Isaiah 49, verse 23. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to the earth with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me.
1 Timothy 2, verse 1 and 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
Matthew 2, 4 and 5. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea. For thus it is written by the prophet.
Proverbs 11, verse 14. Where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety.
Okay, they actually give us a couple other verses in the proof text, or a couple of, actually two full chapters out of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 29 and 30, and a few verses out of 2 Chronicles 19. Some of these verses we'll have in our readings. We'll pick up a couple of verses here and there. But those, I just want to call your attention to those chapters because they do have bearing on this question. And we are going to take a closer look at 2 Chronicles 19 in the course of going through this, but perhaps not as much of 2 Chronicles 29:30. As the divines would have us examine. I also would like to note that there are people who think it's it's crazy that they've placed this proof text from Matthew in this point. This idea that Herod is calling on the church, essentially, to tell him where Jesus is going to be born. And, to that, I've responded elsewhere in some things that I did on Matthew's Gospel on this point. But I want to, I'll summarize it in this way. If going before Herod and giving the answer had been inherently sinful, there's no reason to believe that these people would have done that. In fact, we see elsewhere, for example, that the Magi leave and go another way when they realize what Herod is up to, when that's revealed to them. But the notion that what he's doing is inherently wrong, I think, is dealt a serious reason for doubting when you see several points here. One is they do respond to his call. He's the one who makes the call. They do respond to his call. His call is respecting a question, a matter of religion, interpreting the Bible with regard to a certain point, which they're competent to do. He's recognizing that. And they are careful to interpret the Bible accurately in their response. All of that has the character of something which is imitable. You know, there's not only nothing unlawful going on there, there seems to be something, in fact, laudable in their interaction. They're responding in a proper obedience to a proper request by a magistrate, regardless of the character of the magistrate right now, without getting into that, yeah.
So they're kind of being charitable then, because they don't know of his intentions, so they think maybe he's reforming for good. But if you know that a magistrate wants information to do evil, would it be wrong to deny him that information?
Well, that's a different question that we'll deal with in a hind let loose. But the short answer is, you know, we're not under obligation to, although we're always under obligation when we speak to speak the truth, we're not under obligation to speak all the truth all the time. Especially when we know that it could jeopardize someone's life or, you know, do some unintended harm. or perhaps if we know that it was intended for harm. So, anyway, thus do the papists err, maintaining the civil magistrate has no right or power to convocate synods or councils, but that it belongs to the bishop to convocate diocesan synods, to the metropolitan to convocate provincial synods, to the primate and patriarch to convocate national synods, to the Pope only to convocate ecumenical and general synods. That's generally how it's been, certainly at the time of the assembly. That changes a little bit in Romish theology with Vatican I in 1870 and the establishing of the dogma regarding papal infallibility. But the general chain of command, I think, is still there. The late 1950s, around 1960, Vatican II was convocated by Pope John. And that, again, that's one of the prerogatives that they would yield to the Pope to convocate what they consider ecumenical and general synods. But we think they're wrong in saying that that's the only competent power to convocate a synod. Likewise, do they err who maintain that the magistrate may not seek the consultation and advice of such a synod? And in some sense, that second point is a point of contention, again, in what we would consider to be Western liberal democracies. They have this idea of a separation of church and state. And the idea that the magistrate then would seek consultation and advice of a synod is, I think, to post-Enlightenment people largely an historical anomaly. You know, we're beyond that. That was primitive, or that was something that went the way of the dinosaur. And I don't mean to advocate that I believe that there were dinosaurs. Or dragons. But anyway. That's a different topic. So, we want to talk about these synods that are called by the magistrate, why we would confute these. And so we're going to look at a number of verses and consider them. The following reasons given are, first, because the custody of the divine law was committed to the magistrate by divine command. Look at Deuteronomy 17, 18 and 19.
Deuteronomy 17, verses 18 and 19. And it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that you shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them.
The command, that command is repeated in Joshua 1:8.
Joshua 1:8, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and that then thou shalt have good success.
Also we see in the solemn inauguration of Joash, the book of the law is given to him by Jehoiada, the priest, that he may understand that the guardianship of it has been committed to him. 2 Kings 11:12.
And he brought forth the king's son and put the crown upon him and gave him the testimony. And they made him king and anointed him. And they clapped their hands and said, God save the king.
And this command is confirmed from other passages which suppose the magistrate ought to have a special care for religion. Psalm 2:11 and 12, Psalm 72:10 and 11, and again 1 Timothy 2:2.
Psalm 2, verses 11 and 12, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him.
Psalm 72:10 and 11, the kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him, all nations shall serve him.
1 Timothy 2, verse 2, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty.
So, the idea, first of all, that we have to keep in mind is this. According to Scripture, the king is, the magistrate, the chief magistrate, is responsible not only for what we consider second table law issues, honoring thy father and mother, not murdering, no adultery, no stealing, no lying, coveting, which is, as Paul points out, more of a spiritual precept. It points out the spiritual requirements of the whole law. But there are a lot of people who say, well, the magistrate has this authority over the second table. And while he does have a decided presence with regard to second table matters, because those are matters that pertain generally between man and man, and that is the province of the magistrate. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have any concern for the first table of the law. But the reformers all would confess that he is a custodian of both tables of the law, that it is up to him to see that other aspects of the law are enforced. And so they didn't see an inconsistency, for example, with the magistrate having laws against idolatry or blasphemy or Sabbath breaking. These were all things that would have been well within what they believed to be his rightful duty, because they pertain to matters circa sacra, concerning sacred things, but they're not in sacred things. He's not defining doctrine or practice within the church, but he has an obligation to see that practice within the civil realm, it bears a general conformity to that practice within the church. And he has an obligation to see that the true religion is in some sense upheld and supported. So, in order to do this, he needs to be aware of... He's not allowed to define what is or is not heresy. Okay, it doesn't fall to the magistrate to make that determination. But once he knows what is heresy, and he has every reason to believe that it is right and scriptural and so on, he has an obligation to see that heretics are, in some respect, restrained, in some way sanctioned or punished, yes.
So hypothetically, this is the question I wanted to ask last week. You told me to ask it this week. If you have, say, a reforming magistrate, and the church is in complete disarray, and the magistrate calls the council together to rule on whatever error or heresy. Let's just say Arminianism, for example. And let's say the church rules in favor of Arminianism when the magistrate knows that it's wrong. Does the magistrate then have the ability to go back to a previous council, like the Synod of Dort, and then enforce that and disregard what this heretical ruling of the church?
At that point, you know, a church that's ruling in that way has become a false church, right? So, you know, we've got a couple of different considerations. Is he present at a council of the church, or is this a council he's called? If it's a council he's called, then we need to ask, you know, how did these people get there? There are a lot of questions, and actually we're going to see the very opposite thing actually happened for real in Holland with the Synod of Dort. The magistrate called the Synod of Dort, and the Arminians were put, because they were offering a viewpoint contrary to the received viewpoint of the Dutch Church. That was what was in contest, and the people that were called to answer were Orthodox. And furthermore, in order to make sure that this was that the church itself was Orthodox, the magistrate had requested delegates from other Reformed churches in and around Holland. So the English were there. There were, I believe, French there. Germans were there. Swiss were there. There were others who were there, who all assented with the Dutch. And the only way Arminianism really escaped was because of, in Holland, the government was decentralized, and there were some local provinces that gave aid and comfort to Arminianism and allowed it to spread. But the magistrate was really you know, they were responsible for calling people like Gomaris and Boogerman and others of that sort to fight against Episcopius and the other Arminian, the Arminian faction.
Quick side question on that. Because there's no power to deform, wouldn't a council like that sort of cut its own feet out from underneath it?
Yes.
Mm. I mean,
there's no authority there.
In the example that he gave, there obviously was already this ruling against Arminianism. So, and would that be the position of the magistrate to say, no, guys, you're not?
Yeah. No council, regardless of whether it was called by a magistrate or convened by ministers, has authority to deform, and we're going to get into that a little bit more in one of the later sections. There is no authority like that, and there are other issues I suppose we could consider regarding the power of synods and councils. You know, they once something has been adjudicated by the General Assembly, if it's true, you can't ever go back. There's no authority in any General Assembly that can undo what a reformed and reforming General Assembly has done. No subsequent General Assembly can ever undo that, because they don't have the authority to undo it. That's one reason why the Church is bound to what these reformed General Assemblies have done, regardless of the time period. Because no amount of time is going to unbind the Church to the truth. And having... It's one thing when there's error in a church and that error has crept in because no one has really considered it. But once the church considers it and purges it out, to bring it back in is to do so not only without authority, which is what they did the first time, but against real lawful authority, which is what that authority is, to purge the church of those sorts of things. All right, second. Because under the Old Testament, councils and synods were appointed and called by God to kings. If we look at 1 Kings 8:1, 2 Kings 23:1, 2 Chronicles 29:4.
1 Kings 8, verse 1. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. 2 Kings 23:1. And the king sent, and they gathered unto him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem.
And 2 Chronicles 29, verse 4. And he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together into the east street.
Now, this is a little bit of a tricky proposition that we're talking about here. Because when we're talking about the Old Testament, we always have to ask, you know, is this typical? Right? Is this just a type or a shadow? Or is this something that is exemplary? Is something that we can view instructively? And so the answer is, we have to ask ourselves, is there any part of that action which is typical? For example, carrying up the ark is typical, but convening people to do that, is that typical, or is that really just a matter of commanding something regarding religious circumstance? And I would say it's the latter. And then we have to ask, is that power of the magistrate to command in that regard, is that typical? And there, I think, if we look carefully at the data, the answer is no, it's not typical. There's nothing peculiarly Jewish about that. Right? There's there's nothing where you can say, well, there that doesn't have any or admit of any imitability in a Gentile king. Right, so some things the kings did as moral examples. What they're doing is they're enacting what pertains to natural moral law, and sometimes they're enacting and supporting peculiarly Jewish usages. In the latter case, it's not imitable. But in the former case, it's not only imitable, it actually stands as an approved example, and an approved example has the force of a command. So we see them doing these sorts of things, calling together people, leaders in the church, to effect what might be considered an Old Testament reform. We see that the kings have that power to call the members, the leaders of the church together, and press them to reform. All they're doing really is pressing them to do their duty. Okay, they're not telling them what is their duty in every point. Now, that said, we should keep in mind, a lot of times they do already have some idea of what the duty is, right? Especially as time has gone on, because the creed of the church is open to them. You know, they know that there are certain creedal commitments to the church. And so they know if that synod is going contrary to that creed, at least at some level. They're in a position to be aware of that. So they're not flying blind into calling a synod. And they too have a right to read the Bible and they have a right of what we call, not private interpretation, but private judgment, to lend their private judgment. But when you're a magistrate, you have another right and even duty, which is to lend your public judgment when you find it to be scriptural. You have to uphold the Word of God wherever you are in your person and station in life. Or third, because the titles given to magistrates in Scripture would imply this. If we look at, again, at Isaiah 49:23, Isaiah 60, verse 10, Psalm 82:6, Isaiah 44:28, and 1 Samuel 24:11.
Isaiah 49:23, "And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me."
Isaiah 60, verse 10, "And the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls, and their kings shall minister unto thee. For in my wrath I smote thee, but in my favor have I had mercy on thee."
Psalm 82, 6, "I have said, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High."
Isaiah 44, verse 28, "Then saith Osiris, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid."
1 Samuel 24:11, "Moreover, my father, see the skirt of thy robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the skirt of thy robe and killed thee not, know thou and see that there is neither evil nor transgression in my hand, and I have not sinned against thee, yet thou huntest my soul to take it."
So the idea that they're called fathers, that they're called gods, that they're called nursing fathers, those kinds of terms, ministers, mine anointed, that kind of language tells us that magistrates do have a responsibility toward the church. Right? They have something of a power circa sacra, not in sacris, but circa sacra, concerning sacred things. They're not determining doctrine or practice, but they are in a position to enforce doctrine and practice, particularly within the civil realm. They can uphold and should uphold certain civil standards with respect to the true religion. Right, we have fourth the approved examples of kings and magistrates. Moses administering the office of a king of the people, Deuteronomy 33:5.
Deuteronomy 33:5. And he was king in Jeshurun when the heads of the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together.
Moses is called king in Jeshurun. David takes care of the ark to be brought back and appoints singers and distributes the duties of Levites in 1 Chronicles 15:16 and 23:6.
1 Chronicles 15:16, and David spake to the chief of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be the singers with instruments of music, psalteries and harps and cymbals, sounding by lifting up the voice with joy.
1 Chronicles 23:6, and David divided them into courses among the sons of Levi, namely Gershon, Kohath, and Merari.
Also, we have David preparing all things necessary for the building of the temple, 1 Chronicles 22:2.
1 Chronicles 22:2, and David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel, and he set masons to hew wrought stones to build the house of God.
We see in the case of Solomon removes Abiathar from office and puts Zadok in his place, 1 Kings 2:27.
1 Kings 2:27, so Solomon thrust out Abiathar from being priest unto the Lord, that he might fulfill the word of the Lord, which he spake concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh.
And he builds the temple, 1 Kings 6:1.
1 Kings 6:1. And it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord.
In the case of King Asa, overthrowing the altars and statues of foreign worship, and he cuts down groves, in 1 Kings 15:12 and 15, and 2 Chronicles 14:4.
1 Kings 15:12, and he took away the Sodomites out of the land, and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. 15, and he brought in the things which his father had dedicated, and the things which himself had dedicated into the house of the Lord, silver and gold and vessels.
2 Chronicles 14:4, and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers, and to do the law and the commandment.
Jehoshaphat brings about a reformation and ordains an ecclesiastical and political senate. 2 Chronicles 19, and we want to, I don't know how many verses off the top of my head here, but break it, do about 10 verses each, toward to the end.
2 Chronicles 19, and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem, and Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him, and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. Nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, and that thou hast taken away the groves out of the land, and hast prepared thine heart to seek God. And Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again through the people from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim, and brought them back unto the Lord God of their fathers. And he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed what ye do, for ye judge not for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judgment.
Wherefore, now let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take heed and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no respect of persons, nor taking of gifts. Moreover, in Jerusalem, to Jehoshaphat, said of the Levites and of the priests and of the chief of the fathers of Israel, for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies when they return to Jerusalem. And he charged them, saying, thus shall ye do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a perfect heart. And what cause soever shall come to you of your brethren that dwell in your cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and judgments, ye shall even warn them that they trespass not against the Lord, and so wrath come upon you and upon your brethren. This do, and ye shall not trespass. And behold, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebadiah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters, also the Levites, shall be officers before you. Deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good.
Okay, so, you know, I forgot how short the chapter was. here again, though, the point of all of these verses, as we see, is the king is exerting himself on behalf of the church, the true religion. And he's doing that which is really it's a reforming work. But it's not an internal reform, if you will. It has to do with external things. So let's look at a couple more. Joash restores the temple, 2 Kings 12. 4 and 5.
2 Kings 12, 4 and 5. And Joash said to the priests, all the money of the dedicated things that is brought into the house of the Lord, even the money of everyone that passeth the account, the money that every man is set at, and all the money that cometh into any man's heart to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it to them, every man of his acquaintance, and let them repair the breaches of the house wheresoever any breach shall be found.
Hezekiah takes away the high places and destroys the false worship. 2 Kings 18, 4.
2 Kings 18:4. He removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan.
And he repairs and opens the house of the Lord, reforms worship, and enters into covenant with the Lord. 2 Chronicles 29:10.
2 Chronicles 29:10. Now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us.
And then we have Josiah, who publishes the book of the law found by Hilkiah the priest. 2 Kings 23:2 and 2 Chronicles 34:30.
2 Kings 23, verse 2. And the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant which was found in the house of the Lord.
2 Chronicles 34, verse 30. And the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the priests, and the Levites, and all the people, great and small. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that was found in the house of the Lord.
So, again, the point of this is sort of to give us a listing of a number of things. We can see here the magistrate has a number of duties with respect to the true religion. Right? Seeing that places of false religion are destroyed. Seeing that the true religion is maintained by giving support, not just physical support or the communal support, but monetary support. That certain things which were out of order were set in order. Right? Now, a lot of this has to do certainly with times when the church is in some sense unsettled, or in some sense it is disturbed by outward affairs, by outward assaults. But, for example, you know, Solomon removing Abiathar and putting Zadok in his place. You know, There's a case where he is, in a sense, enforcing reform. He's going to make sure that reform comes. He's taking care of the buildings and things like that, yes.
With that example where Solomon obviously deposes one high priest and sets up another, so the magistrate has the authority to remove sinful ministers or unreformed ministers, but does the magistrate have the right to pick another minister, or does that go to the church to give from among themselves and a minister to take that other person's place?
Well, again, you know, we have to talk about the difference between a church and an unconstituted, unsettled state and in a settled state. Right? So when there is a lack of will or a lack of means within the church, then the magistrate has authority. If the magistrate is reformed and reforming, you know, he can do certain things in that case. And they wouldn't be ordinary. Right? This is not an ordinary thing, but in an extraordinary state, when things are not constituted or unsettled, profoundly unsettled, then to do that is really to be studying the reform of the church. Again, you have to consider this in his removing Abiathar and putting in Zadok. He's not telling Zadok what to preach or what to do. Right, he's going for someone who is more concerned with the reform agenda, and removing someone that perhaps is more of an obstacle to that reform agenda.
Was that one of the big things in Erastianism, where the state wanted to put their own ministers in there because the ministers would support the state's agenda?
Well, yeah. If you look at King James's approach, he's looking for ministers who are going to be court toadies. Right? He wants people who are going to do whatever he wants done and not talk back to the king. Solomon's not doing that, as far as we can tell. His concern isn't to silence the church or to reduce the church into an agency of the state. Right. So that's the mark of a real reforming magistrate. We're not talking about Erastianism. But if we were doing this all the time, yeah, it would be Erastian. Right. But you have to remember, in a state, when the church is either not constituted or unsettled, extraordinary things can be done in that time that you wouldn't do when there's a regularization, when things are becoming ordinary. You know, you don't want to do them then at that point. You know, the emphasis should be on that. But again, all the fact that the king has so many responsibilities. You know, I would, if I could summarize all of this, I would say this: what this shows us is this idea of a national establishment wherein the state gives support, financial and other support, to the maintenance and upkeep of the church. Right? That's a moral principle. It's not something peculiarly Jewish. And if he has that power, and I think that's what these and a number of other verses, and if we were to go through 2 Chronicles 29 and 30, you'll see very similar things being talked about. If we understand that as being imitable, laudable, and therefore standing with the force of a command for a godly magistrate, then the idea that the magistrate could call a synod, or even more, that he should be present in the synod to hear what's being conducted, that should really be almost not a question at all. I mean, really, the only question is, is this the only way to do it? Are we Erastian, or are we saying, no, we leave it to a reforming magistrate in a case where the church is unconstituted, unsettled. We recognize he has that kind of an authority to do this, but, you know, if the church is doing its job, he doesn't need to call these synods all the time. He can get what he needs most of the time simply by showing up when they're having them. And if there's a question that is agitated in matters of state, and he knows that they're having a general assembly every year, if it can wait, he'll wait till then. Especially if he knows it's not far off.
So if the king needs counsel on something in terms of justness or morality in some, I don't know, foreign affairs or some domestic issue or whatever, like you said, if it's a big enough issue, it would be something that would be covered at the General Assembly. And if it...
Well, not necessarily going to be covered, but if he shows up, if he's there, and he raises a question, it could certainly be addressed.
Okay, that was going to be what I asked, how he kind of gets something addressed that he needs addressed.
You know, in a General Assembly, there is a sense in which General Assemblies are open to appeal or, for the purposes of settling an unsettled question, to anyone in the church. Okay, anyone can go, and as long as they follow the matter, pursue the matter in an orderly way, then they're going to not have a problem there, right? No, there's not going to be an issue. So they need to be careful about that, okay? As long as it's orderly, everything will be fine. The real issue where Erastianism comes in is when things are not being done in an orderly fashion. Okay, when things are out of order, that's when the church, or when the magistrate is going to step in anyway. Mm. Okay, so the magistrate, the responsibility to some extent is going to be on the magistrate to restrain himself. You know, don't go beyond circus sacra. Don't try to insert yourself into a part of the problem. And even here, you have to be careful because James was trying to pack the court, and through that packing of the church courts, affect a change in interpretation and usage in the church. That's tampering and meddling, right? That is Erastian. And any lawful church assembly should resist that. But simply to call them together and have them consult, you know, Westminster Assembly, those men were not only called together, but they were all granted a stipend. They had a living. Wasn't necessarily great. Some of them actually gave up quite a bit to follow that course. But that said, those people also were willing to do whatever at the end of the day on behalf of the church for that amount of money that had been set aside by the magistrate. Right. Five. Because it's the duty of the civil magistrate, being born within the church, to take care that peace and unity be preserved and kept in the church, that the truth and word of God be entirely and soundly preached and obeyed, that blasphemies and heresies be kept under and suppressed, that all corruptions in worship and discipline be reformed, that all God's ordinances be lawfully established, administered, and preserved. He has that, and that's really what we've shown with a lot of these verses. He has that responsibility. He has to pursue that. If he's going to do that, he needs the advice, the consent, the consultation of lawful synods. But if it should happen that both church and state judicatories should make a universal defection from the purity of doctrine and worship received and acknowledged, it's the duty of a godly king, by virtue of his regal power and authority, to set about a work of reformation and to call and command all ranks of people to return to the true worship and service of God. Again, let's look at Isaiah, this time Isaiah 45:23, Psalm 122:7-9, Ezra 7:23, and then 25-28, Leviticus 24:16, Deuteronomy 13:5-12, 1 Chronicles 13:1-9, 2 Kings 23:1-25, and that one, whoever gets that, break it up. Somebody can do 12 and somebody 13, or 13 and 12, right?
Isaiah 45:23, I have sworn by myself, the word has gone out of my mouth in righteousness and shall not return, but unto me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear.
Psalm 122:7-9, peace be within thy walls and prosperity within thy palaces, for my brethren and companions' sakes. For my brethren and companions' sakes, I will now say, peace be within me. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek thy good.
Ezra 7:23. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? In verses 25-28. And thou, Ezra, after the wisdom of thy God that is in thine hand, set magistrates and judges which may judge all the people that are beyond the river, all such as know the laws of thy God, and teach ye them that know them not. And whosoever will not do the law of thy God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be unto death, or to banishment, or to a confiscation of goods, or to imprisonment. Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, which hath put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Lord which is in Jerusalem, and hath extended mercy unto me before the king and his counselors, and before all the king's mighty princes, and I was strengthened by the hand of the Lord my God. And I was strengthened as the hand of the Lord thy God was upon me. And I gathered together out of Israel chief men to go up with me.
Leviticus 24:16. And he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well the stranger as he that is born in the land. When he blasphemeth the name of the Lord, shall be put to death.
Deuteronomy 13:5-6. And that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has spoken to turn you away from the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of bondage, to thrust thee out of the way which the Lord thy God commanded thee to walk in. So shalt thou put the evil away from the midst of thee. And verse 12, if thou shalt hear say in one of thy cities which the Lord thy God hath given thee to dwell there, saying,
1 Chronicles 13:1-9, and David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and with every leader, and David said unto all the congregation of Israel, if it seem good unto you, and that it be of the Lord our God, let us send abroad unto our brethren everywhere that are left in all the land of Israel, and with them also to the priests and Levites which are in their cities and suburbs, that they may gather themselves unto us, and let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we inquired not at it in the days of Saul. And all the congregation said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. So David gathered all Israel together, from Shihor of Egypt, even unto the entering of Hemath, to bring the ark of God from Kirjath-Jearim. And David went up, and all Israel, to Bala, that is, to Kirjath-Jearim, which belonged to Judah, to bring up thence the ark of God the Lord that dwelleth between the cherubims, whose name is called on it. And they carried the ark of God in a new cart out of the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio drave the cart. And David and all Israel played before God with all their might, and with singing, and with harps, and with psalteries, and with timbrels, and with cymbals, and with trumpets. And when they came unto the threshing floor of Kidon, Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled.
Kings 23:1-12. And the king sent, and they gathered unto him all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. And the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant which was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all their heart and all their soul, to perform the words of this covenant of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people stood to the covenant, and the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the keepers of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal, and for the grove, and for all the hosts of the heaven of heaven. And he burned them without Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and carried the ashes of them to Bethel. And he put down the idolatrous priests whom the king of Judah and whom the king of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah, and in the places round about Jerusalem. Them also that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, and to the moon, and to the plant, and to the planets, and to all the hosts of heaven. And he brought out the groves from the house of the Lord without Jerusalem unto the brook Kidron, and burned it at the brook Kidron, and stamped it small to powder, and cast the powder thereof upon the graves of the children of the people. And he brake down the houses of the Sodomites that were by the house of the Lord, where the women wove hanging for the grove. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah, and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense, from Gibeah to Beersheba, and brake down the high places of the gates that were in the entering in of the gates of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on a man's left hand at the gate of the city. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they did eat of the unleavened bread among the their brethren. And he defiled Topheth, which is the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter to pass through the fire of Molech. And he took away the horses that the king of Judah had given to the son at the entering into the house of the Lord by the chamber of Nathan-Melech and the chamberlain, which was in the suburbs, and burned the chariots of the son with fire, and the altars that were on the top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the king of Judah had made, and the altars which Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of the Lord, did the king beat down and break them down from thence, and cast the dust of them into the brook Kidron.
And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon the king of Israel had builded for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of the children of Ammon, did the king defile. And he brake in pieces the images, and cut down the groves, and filled their places with the bones of men. Moreover, the altar that was at Bethel, and the high place which Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, had made, both that altar and the high place he brake down, and burned the high place, and stamped it small to powder, and burned the grove. And as Josiah turned himself, he spied the sepulchres that were there in the mount, and sent, and took the bones out of the sepulchres, and burned them upon the altar, and polluted it, according to the word of the Lord, which the man of God proclaimed, who proclaimed these words. Then he said, "What title is that that I see?" And the men of the city told him, "It is the sepulchre of the man of God, which came from Judah, and proclaimed these things that thou hast done against the altar of Bethel." And he said, "Let him alone, let no man move his bones." So they let his bones alone, with the bones of the prophet that came out of Samaria. And all the houses also of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria, which the kings of Israel had made to provoke the Lord to anger, Josiah took away, and did to them according to all the acts he had done in Bethel. And he slew all the priests of the high places that were upon the altars, and burned men's bones upon them, and returned to Jerusalem. And the king commanded all the people, saying, "Keep the Passover unto the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of this covenant." Surely there was not holden such a Passover from the days of the judges that judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel, nor of the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, wherein the Passover was holden to the Lord in Jerusalem. Moreover, the workers with familiar spirits, and the wizards, and the images, and the idols, and all the abominations that were spied in the land of Judah and Jerusalem, did Josiah put away, that he might perform the words of the law which were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest had found in the house of the Lord. And like unto him was there no king before him that turned to the Lord with all his heart, and with all his soul, and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, neither after him arose there any like him.
Okay, so you know, what we see is not only the idea that it's the duty of a godly king to reform, to set about a work of reformation when the church is in a state of disarray, but the idea of suppressing corruption in worship, reforming discipline, suppressing blasphemy and heresy. Well, these are all moral obligations. They're not peculiarly Jewish. these are things which belong to the whole church, and, or I should say, to all magistrates toward the church. The fact is that these magistrates are acting from moral, natural moral principles, and those moral principles are being enacted with respect to the true religion.
Because later nature tells you that you need to have order among people, right?
Well, there's that issue of order, but there's also the issue of the fact that the light of nature tells you that there is a God and that he needs to be worshipped. Right? And that, who that God is and how he's to be worshipped, you need special revelation, but they're getting that in the Old Testament. And so what they're doing with that is exactly what we would expect to see based upon moral principle. Now that, again, if they have this obligation, then they're going to have, in fact, not only an obligation to be present at synods, but if the church is not reformed and reforming, then they need to be able to call for a reformed and reforming synod. You know, so that they can do their duty. Okay, the point is we do recognize a separation and a distinction between church and state. And it's precisely because of that that they're being required to do that. Just for example, you know, in the United States, how do they determine what is and is not a legitimate religion? They have no synod, which means that they're making determinations, religious determinations, on their own. That means they're functioning as an Erastian establishment. And they're doing it based upon principles of false religion.
Isn't like the Congress and the Senate, aren't they like their own synods and councils?
When they take up any matter that pertains to religion in particular or requires the input of religion, yes, they're functioning in a way that requires that kind of input. They're supplying what's required without consultation with the church. And that means that they're presuming to teach. Mm. They're presuming to legislate. And of course, the very fact that all legislation, by making some things right and some things wrong, is legislating morality, there is this ethical and therefore this this higher religious claim to most, if not all, of what they're doing. Mm. And so there ought to be a way of consulting. All right. The sixth thing, and I've alluded to this with the Synod of Dort, but we have the example of Constantine, who did convocate the First Nicene Council. From Theodosius the Elder, called the First Council of Constantinople. Theodosius the Younger, called the First Council of Ephesus. Martianus, called the Council of Chalcedon. Those four councils, by the way, are the first four ecumenical councils. They're the ones that dealt with these big issues of who is Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity and so on. So it's kind of amazing, actually, that Romanism would deny that a magistrate could lawfully call a council, since the early ecumenical councils, which are agreed upon by all Orthodox churches, they were all convened at the behest of the magistrate. Now, again, their bindingness, when they're adopted by the churches, that's when they get their power. But ecumenical councils, by the very nature, are probably going to be called by a magistrate rather than by the church. The church, the ordinary highest body in any church is going to be the national body, the National General Assembly, the National Great National Synod. To have something beyond that, you need some sort of political structuring that is in some sense transcending that to get to a point of this ecumenical council. Yeah,
would the churches have a right though to call an ecumenical council? Say there were no magistrates willing to call or just didn't care. Could a bunch of different church delegates from different countries get together and have their own ecumenical council? Like, is that not permissible, or just this is very highly irregular and you wouldn't expect it's, it?
For whatever reason, the ecumenical councils that the Reformed churches accept have all been called by magistrates. Now, I would argue, in fact, that the Church of Rome is a quasi-political entity, and so in reserving to itself the power to call these ecumenical councils, it's really, you know, doing so as a political entity. All right. Question two. May not ministers of the church or themselves, by virtue of their office, meet in assemblies with other fit persons upon delegation from their churches when magistrates are open enemies to the Christian religion? And the answer here is yes. We don't deny that. In fact, ordinarily, this is the way the church is going to deal with problems. Issues. Look at Acts 15, 2, 4, 22, 23, 25.
Acts 15, verse 2. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. Verse 4. And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. Verses 22 and 23, then it pleased the apostles and elders with the whole church to send chosen men of their own company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, namely Judas, surnamed Barsabbas, and Silas, chief men among the brethren, and they wrote letters by them after this manner. The apostles and elders and brethren send greeting unto the brethren which are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia. Verse 25, it seemed good unto us, being assembled with one accord, to send chosen men unto you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul.
Okay, thus then do the Erastians err, maintaining that the ministers of the gospel have no right or power in themselves, or by virtue of their office, to meet in a synod or council. Again, we're spending much less time on this, because this is probably, from most people's point of view, the less controverted point here. Although we could, I think, make some arguments regarding Erastianism and the fact that the problem today is not open Erastianism so much as this closeted, hidden Erastianism that appears at most junctures in modern society. People just don't recognize it for what it is. Right, they're confuted for the following reasons. Number one, because the Church of God in the primitive times had power in themselves to convocate their own assemblies for worship and government, not without, but even against the consent of the civil magistrate, as evidenced from the Acts of the Apostles in Acts 5, 27 to 29.
Acts 5, 27 through 29. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them, saying, Did not we straitly command you that ye should not teach in this name? Behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men.
Right. We also have in other church histories, we find similar stances on the part of the church. The church has historically gotten together regardless of the attitude of the magistrate. That's been a common occurrence. Again, that's not without apostolic warrant. So the idea that we need the magistrate to call a synod is false. We don't. After all, the church has plenty of reasons to maintain general assemblies or synods or presbyteries. There's plenty of business for the church to conduct. The first point really has to do with respect to matters that pertain to the magistrate, and the magistrate gaining insight, instruction, consultation. But the church has its own interior life, if you will. And that life is separate and separable from the civil realm. And so in that regard, there needs to be this power in the church to have higher courts than just a local congregational session. Right. Second, though the power and right of meeting in church assemblies is visible in the Constitution and exercise, yet it is intrinsic within the church as well as the power of preaching. Acts 15:2 and Titus 1:5.
Acts 15, verse 2. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question.
Titus 1, verse 5. For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I appointed thee.
So the church, again, has in its constitution and exercise the right of meeting, and there's a power intrinsic, as well as a power of preaching, right? A power to make determinations regarding controversies of faith. That's not something that is extrinsic. In other words, if only magistrates could call synods or councils, then the power to call synods and councils would be extrinsic. But there's this intrinsic power because there's this intrinsic need in the church as well to consult. Right? We very often comes to pass that there's a need for broader counsel in some matter or some issue that affects more than one area of the church, some heresy perhaps that's arisen and is attacking more than one small geographic slice of the church. Those kinds of things mean that it's necessary for the church to have this intrinsic power, and we see in the book of Acts it does. Yeah.
Say there was some heresy that was, you know, worldwide. It was spreading worldwide. Would it be best for the churches to issue national, you know, like national testimonies against it, or would it be better to, like, to do an ecumenical council where all the churches combine and they issue an ecumenical kind of statement against it?
Again, we see these broader, more ecumenical statements usually arising through the agency of magistrates for whatever reason. Even the Westminster Assembly is, you know, it's to settle government, doctrine, government, worship, and discipline in the three kingdoms. You know, it's called by the Parliament for that purpose. It's still, you know, for whatever reason in the history of the church, it seems to be there's always a magistrate involved in that. I'm unaware of anything ecumenical that is happening, and I suppose it has in part at least to do with the fact that you need some sort of an arbiter over a bunch of national churches or provincial churches. You need some sort of moderating, yeah. There has to be something there calling them to it. Now, again, you know, the findings of these councils are are not necessarily binding until they're adopted by the various churches. But there is implied in going up to an ecumenical council a covenant, a covenanting. In fact, this idea of covenanting, I know people think that it arises with Westminster, but if you were to read the minutes and the introductory statements to the Council of Chalcedon in 451, they understood what they were doing as a matter of covenanting. They were covenanting to come together to deal with this problem of you had Nestorianism and Apollinarianism going on at that point. They were struggling to defeat, but they're trying to secure the Orthodox doctrine of the person and deity of Christ, and that tells you that when they went there, they sort of placed themselves under an obligation to consult and consult until they had finally come to a point of agreement that this is what Scripture is teaching, and then to go back to their home churches, their regional, provincial, national churches, and see that what was settled there was in fact adopted in those local bodies. But again, the power to call these councils is intrinsic in the church. And so, you know, is it possible that in some case that you would have something like that? I suppose it's possible. I'm just pointing out historically, it has not been the case. When we look at the early church, or when we look at the Synod of Dort or the Westminster Assembly. Both of those, to a certain extent, are Reformed and what we might consider a bit more ecumenical. The Synod of Dort more so than Westminster, but there is an eye to ecumenism. So that has something, I think, to do with you know, the reason why there's a magistrate involved, that ultimately there seems to be this recognition that what they're doing has broader impact, perhaps, than just one national assembly of the church, one national establishment. But anyway, what these councils and synods have the power to do, the power within them, that intrinsic power, that's really going to be what we're going to talk about next time. What it is they can do and why they can do it, and how we should view what they do and why we should view it that way. All of which are important to understanding why it is we're Presbyterian.